and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. This is episode 546, and I'm the co-host Mark Ames here in Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe, please, and support our show. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Breccia in southern Italy. How's it going, John?
Well, it's a day of rejoicing here because we thought the battle painting that some listeners may know because we talked about having commissioned it. It's a massive painting. Like it's like 3 meters wide and 1.5 meters long. Of the storming of the Red Fort in Sulamania. And we commissioned it from this Repin fan who's...
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah, a Russian historical painter disciple. Right. And he did a really beautiful painting of it. But then he wasn't finished when we had to leave because it took months. And we were invited not to come the hell back by the administration. And so other people had to send it to us with a polite note asking for his fee, which was several thousand dollars. So we took about our last several thousand dollars out of the bank, and then, you know, we were naked in Canada for a while, and we paid it to him to get the painting, and it was duly delivered. And then we had to put it in storage again because we got kind of sick of being poor all the time. We had to go to Saudi Arabia to make a little money. And then it ended up, to make a very long story short, in a shed, in a storage shed in the rainy backside of Port Alberni in Canada, on Vancouver Island. We picked it up from there last year, and we're going to have it shipped to us here in Italy. But although everything else seems to have arrived okay, that apparently had not made the trip. And it was pretty sad because, you know, there was a lot of painful memories wrapped in that painting. And we went back and forth with the shipping company many times. And then Catherine was just unfolding something in this little box that was only like less than 1 meter high. And she called me and said, "It's the painting." And I thought, how? How is it the painting? Well, because, you know, they'd rolled it up like a scroll, and then they'd sort of folded it over, you know, like a note that you pass in high school. And but it was there. It was there. It's just a few faces got scrunched on the militiamen who were attacking the Red Fort. But it's here anyway, and that's the main thing.
When you talk about it, I think of your description in one of your earlier Warner columns about, as a child, visiting those Civil War dioramas, walking around. Yeah. I mean, did it kind of bring back a little bit of that?
Yeah, yeah. Because you can imagine what each figure is doing.
Right,
you know, what they're going to do next. Yeah, there's actually a really good description of that childish habit in Saki, that bitter short story writer in Shredni Vashtar. He goes up to the attic to look at this old tapestry of a hunter who's surrounded by wolves, and he goes up to think whether the hunter would survive or whether the wolves would survive, and it ends something like, "On the whole, he thought the hunter would not survive," or something like that. And yeah, you very vividly picture the next stage. Mm.
Yeah, speaking of Repin, by the way, it just reminded me that there's been since Russia's full-scale invasion, as we call it, in February 2022, There's been this movement to both, try to basically cancel Russian arts, Russian musician, you know, Russian music? Why do we listen to Tchaikovsky? Why do we listen to Rachmaninoff, etc.? Why? Same with the artists, the writers. Why Dostoevsky? Why Tolstoy? They're all imperialist. And with
even
Repin,
Bulgakov. Why Bulgakov?
Yes. Why Bulgakov?
Damn stupid question. But yes. Anyway.
And with Repin, what they've done, they realize it's kind of hard to get him removed from museums. So instead, they had him reclassified, like waged campaigns to be reclassified as Ukrainian, because he was born in the Kharkiv area, sort of near the border of modern, but within the border of modern day Ukraine. And so a lot of museums and stuff did that. I don't know if that's still a thing. It definitely was for a while. I think the Met even reclassified him. I mean, nobody wanted to be like, no, I'm standing by Russia. There was not much to be. Yeah.
Not in the Met world, because those are all people who take the New York Times editorial page very seriously.
Yes. And don't want to be written up as the people who refuse to reclassify as Ukrainian. Yeah. Right. So today, let's get to part three of your series on Byron and poetry and war and the Greek Revolt.
Yeah. This one is going to be fairly kinetic, if we have fans of the kinetic out there, and I'm sure we do. But just to recap, quick recap what we've done before, the 1820s are a poorly understood period in modern history for I think most of us, and it's all too familiar. It's a feeling of letdown and aftermath, and the century began in a glorious way, or what seemed glorious. Then came the French Revolution and the cratering of the European world into the Napoleonic and anti-Napoleonic worlds. And after Napoleon's final defeat at Waterloo, there's a general reactionary shift, a really terrible reactionary shift throughout Europe, which is very depressing to most cultural figures, including Lord Byron. But there's also a general romanticism about Greece, partly fueled by the sudden prosperity of the Greek merchants who migrated from the rather frightening Turkish world into the Odessa and the other southern provinces of Russia. This is also helped by Byron's travel book, which, by the way, as I've said, I don't think is very good. His travel book, the one that made him famous, Child Harold, it's full of Keatsian fake archaisms. And I think, if you want to read some Byron, read Don Juan. Please don't read Child Harold. But it made him instantly famous. It was sentimental enough that it fit right into the era when young Werther killing himself made made millions of Europeans cry, when really he should have just bucked up, the bastard. But anyway, so this drew a lot of attention to Greece and its rather horrible plight under Ottoman rule. And the funny thing there is that, contrary to a lot of public panics, it was quite a horrible plight. But it wasn't exactly the kind of horrible plight that the Northern European intelligentsia thought. That is, these were not people who were Greeks of the Golden Age, suddenly under the Turkish heel, as they called it. They didn't even understand that Greece had had a Golden Age. They thought of themselves as oppressed people because they were Christians and they were under the rule of other peoples who decided to define themselves by religion, only to find themselves as Muslim and considered Christians second-class citizens at best. The expat Greeks developed during this time And they were mostly the children of that prosperous Greek expat community in southern Russia. And they were the only ones who, having gone to school with the Europeans, did sort of feel this community with the ancient Greeks. Like, oh, you know, you go to school and you're like, oh, wow, you're Greek. You know Plato? You know Aristotle? Yeah, sure. And they thought of themselves as heirs of that tradition, and many of them joined a society called Philiki Eteria, Society of Friends. And by the way, I owe thanks to Ilias Stathos for correcting me on the meaning of that term. Mm-hmm. And they were willing to join the very romantic young Europeans who had been really doomed by the failure of the Napoleonic idea from one idea of heroism and self-sacrifice, who were now searching around for another idea of those ways of dying gloriously. And they found it in Greek, in the Philhellenes. And so these Philhellenes and their Greek counterparts, Philiki Eteria, were a real power. They still were not in tune with the Greek population at all. The Greek population was very hard-headed, mostly illiterate, mostly peasant or bandit-oriented, but very devoted to its church and not very happy with the Turkish rule. The Turkish rule was not a very happy thing for anyone outside of a few families in the heart of the empire, but it was particularly unhappy for the Greek community. So this is the situation we have when Byron enters the story. 1820, while Byron is feeling increasingly uncomfortable in Britain and is finally about to leave Britain because he's accused of an incestuous relationship with his half-sister and may have been involved in one, I don't know. He moves to Italy, various parts of Italy, Venice, Ravenna, and he says that he has abandoned what he calls the moral north, ironically, once and for all. And as I've said, the rest of the progress of his life is going to be due southeast. It's like he's trying to get as far as he can from Britain. Meanwhile, there is finally a Greek revolutionary movement in 1820. In December of that year, Prince Ypsilantis, where is there there's a town called Ypsilanti, isn't there?
It sounds familiar. Yeah.
Ypsilanti or something. I don't know. I guess it was named after him.
Yeah, it's a town in Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just looking it up, a little bit different from the Plato and Socrates thing. It's known as the home to the first Domino's pizza.
That would have ended the revolution right there. Okay, I'm going home. It's like we may not have had Plato in Hamburg, but at least we didn't have Domino's pizza. Okay, so Prince Ypsilantis, the new dashing aristocratic leader of the Society of Friends, Philiki Eteria, has decided to launch a rebellion, and he's focusing on launching the rebellion from the sensible place to do so, which is the Mani. The Mani is the Peloponnese, basically, which is that peninsula in the south of Greece. It's like the footprint of a gigantic toad pointing down into the Mediterranean.
Like an upside-down handprint in a cave,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah. And it had always been held more lightly and had felt more independent than the mainland of Greece, because the Turkish armies, occasionally they were a naval power, but they kept losing. Like, we've done an episode on the Battle of Lepanto, and they lost massively in that. Mm-hmm. And they were more at home as a land power, and so they were more at home in northern Greece. So this handprint then has one hand, one finger, as it were, or one claw.
Yeah. You're right. It's south. Almost more like a theropod print. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah. You're right. Yeah. With the three fingers.
And that was
toes.
Where that was the Mani, right? That was where they felt that Greece was wildest and least ruled by the Ottomans and most ripe for rebellion. That was a sensible plan. Unfortunately, after this ditzy prince, and that's the only way I can describe him, he was a ditz of a prince. He was, you know, fond of full dress and military protocol and a jerk, as most of them were. That's the difference between Byron and a lot of people like this. You know, Byron, you can talk about a lot of people who went in for revolutionary tourism. Byron was not like that exactly. He was surprisingly cynical, realistic, and serious about what he was doing. But anyway, the little prince, as we'll call him, changes his mind out of nowhere, and he doesn't tell his emissaries. He is now going to take his army, which is, you know, a couple of thousand men who are fairly well trained in modern weapons, and start the revolt in the Danubian principalities of the Turkish Empire, which are closer to where he is. He's located up there in southern Russia and northern Ottoman principalities. But it's a long way down to the Mani, to the Peloponnese, and he just loses his nerve somehow, doesn't tell anybody. And now he marches his troops into the mainland Danube provinces of the Turkish Empire. Sort of, what is that place?
Well, Moldavia?
Moldova, yeah.
Which is now Moldova and Romania. I mean, I guess the thinking here is, A, it at least has a land border with Russia, and B, the Romanians are Orthodox. So it's kind of... It's easier, at least, than making a sea landing.
It's definitely easier. And I bet he was thinking, if we get into trouble, and many revolutionary groups do plan to get into trouble and be rescued, it's a legitimate strategy. It's just very dangerous. But if we get into trouble, Russia will help us. But this was Tsarist Russia, and he hadn't talked to the Tsars about that. And they got a little peeved. He thought, you know, if we get into trouble in a place that's under Russian influence, at least, then the Tsars will help us and blah, blah, blah. That kind of pipe dream that always gets people killed. But the Tsars were furious, sent word to the Ottomans and to the little prince that he had used their name in vain. It's sort of a mafia thing. Like, you said you were one of mine. I don't even know you. Mm-hmm. Fuck you. Yeah. And so he ends up crossing with 4,500 men, actually, when he gets all his people together, into the Danubian principalities, Moldova, Romania.
Wallachia. And,
all those vampire-y places. And
sounds like an old fall song. I can't remember the name of it, you know. Pomerania, Ruthenia, or something. I can't remember that song, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Pomerania is also off the map.
Free range. That's what it's called. Free range.
The troops don't do very well, and nobody knows what he's talking about around there.
Greeks? What are you talking about, Greeks? You're in Wallachia. Bloody hell.
Yeah, I mean, they have enough troubles of their own. Yeah. And he claims to be an advance party of the Russian army, further infuriating the Tsars. And he calls his troops Hellenes, and he calls also on the Hellenes, who are 1,000 miles away, to rise up. And the funny thing, the Hellenes don't even think of themselves as Hellenes or know the meaning of that term. They are wretched Greek subjects of the Sultan. And their identity, once again, is Orthodox, Christian. They may have used some of those crumbled stones of the ancient Greek temples to, you know, build up their little sheds, but that's about it. That doesn't mean they revere those stones. So nobody knows what this guy is talking about. His troops are confused and furious. And Ypsilanti finally denounces his own men for their cowardice, which is a little unfair. And then flees across the Habsburg border because he's not welcome, to say the least, in Turkey, which is to the east.
Right.
He's very much not welcome in Russia, to the north. So he only has one way to flee, which is to the Habsburg Empire, to the west.
And this guy makes the Bay of Pigs look like prose, man.
It's very, very, very much like Bay of Pigs, only it's not clear that there was yet a U.S. power like that in Europe. Britain would sort of come to be like that, although a little smarter, if I do say so. So that thing is utterly crushed very quickly. Meanwhile, in the Peloponnese, as far as they know, the revolution is still on, and it's going to take place in the south of the Peloponnese. I mean, I feel a little better about some Irish rebellions because they were always getting their wires crossed at the last moment or having people cross them for them. But, you know, this is a slapstick that beggars anything in Irish history because that we're not sure where the revolution is going to take place, and the locations are 1,000 miles apart, but we're also not sure when it's going to take place. And communications are not like they were even in the 20th century when you had newspapers that got their headlines off the telegraph, let alone 21st century when you expect everything to be on the internet instantly. News is very, very slow. These are poor regions. By European standards, they're very slow. Mm-hmm. And so nothing gets rectified. Nobody makes a phone call, hey, the revolution's off. The Greek conspirators still think they are going to have a revolution. And what they mainly mean by this, because everything is seen in terms of your religious community in the Ottoman Empire, that their community, the Greek Orthodox, are going to take their revenge on the Muslim Turk community. They're going to be backed by a big army with Russian backings, and Russia already has a name for not so much sticking up for the Orthodox communities of the Balkans and even further south, but, you know, Russia is all they've got. Russia is the only one who ever expressed sympathy for them. The British and French, it's not our kind of Christian, and they don't particularly like them. So they're waiting for something big. There are rumors throughout the peninsula. The Greek clergy, who are sort of the intelligentsia of the area, they're skeptical, but as one said, to argue against immediate action exposed one to the accusation of being a Turk worshiper, which is, I think, Turkolatris, and you don't want to be that. So they said, well, we believe in it, but we haven't seen it yet. So long after the phony revolt has fizzed out in Moldova, in the spring, the Ottomans noticed that they're Greeks, you know, because they see themselves as sort of managers over these unruly peoples. Their Greeks are behaving oddly. And they do their usual thing, which is they round up about 20 bishops and other notables, 9 senior clinics, 12 primates, sons of notables, and they invite them rather forcibly to come to Tripolitsa, which is like their capital in the Peloponnese. If you imagine a sort of toad hand, which is the Peloponnese, then if you drove a nail through the center of it, that would be Tripolitsa. And their job is to be hostages. And all those people may as well be dead once they get into Tripolitsa, because they're not going to survive what happens after that. On March 15th, a ship arrives in the Peloponnese, bringing the news that Ypsilantis has already launched his revolt 3 weeks earlier. And they realize that he's not coming to the peninsula. But that's only news in a narrow community of real conspirators. The rumors are still flying around the illiterate peasantry, and nobody's clear on what happens. It's just, at this point, it's clear that they are very pissed off, and they've spent generations being taxed at an extortionate rate and giving their sons to the Janissaries and generally being classified as second-class or third-class citizens. And they just want some action. And the rebellion kicks off in a weird ad hoc way. There is no organized military resistance. There's a pattern, and it's very much like Rwanda at this point. Except that in Rwanda, there was no religious divide. There was a largely imagined ethnic divide. But here, it's a very clear religious divide. We're going to kill the Muslims. It's a pattern of episodic violence that turns into uprising as they gather mass like snowballs. The Muslims, and there are lots of Muslims in the Peloponnese, Turkish settlers or Greeks who've converted for various reasons. And the Greeks are violent partly out of revenge and partly out of fear of revenge. Like, if we don't kill these people, they're going to kill us, which was generally true in Greek history. Everyone assumes that the Russians are behind it. There are some weird 20th century echoes here. Like, the Russians get a lot of credit or blame for things that they never had any hand in. The Sultan believes that the Russians did it. But the Russians, in fact, are part of the European consensus, which tries to inculcate a sense of sacredness in kings. You must not do anything bad to your kings, whoever they are, and however, or whether they call themselves sultans. You must never, never, never rise in revolt, because that was what led to the French Revolution, which everybody has been told was a complete nightmare. I think that feeling still survives in a lot of the Anglo population anyway, that the French Revolution was a real horror, which is not quite the case. But that's another story. So the Greeks start to kill Turks who are in the Peloponnese. The Sultan reacts by exhorting his Muslim subjects to carry weapons at all times and behave as warriors of the faith, and rifles are distributed in Constantinople, and Turkish soldiers and Janissaries raid Christian homes, Christian inns, everywhere, supposedly, quote, searching for weapons. And if you know what happens in these situations, mm-hmm. it's always the same. Searching for weapons means give me all your gold, you mm-hmm. know, or give me all your daughters or your sons. And
it's terror. It's a form of terror. Yeah.
Yeah. They kill a lot of people. They're still small scale. They're terrorizing the population, yeah, rather than wiping it out at this point. This is often a prelude to wiping out a community because mm-hmm. you terrorize them into paralysis. And because, you know, people don't always react heroically. Later when it was the Armenians' turn to be annihilated by the Ottomans, they didn't react heroically at all because they were deep in Anatolia and no one could ever help them. Mm-hmm. And they reacted by saying, it's just not happening. I mm-hmm. mean, there's an anecdote I read about a boy who sees his mother and sisters being marched away and then raped and killed, and he comes back to his grandfather and tells him what happens. And his grandfather, he said, he always remembers this, slaps him as hard as he's ever been slapped and said, that did not happen. Uh-huh. And that's a pretty typical reaction to this.
Yeah, that's awful. It's hard to process, I mean, because you're doomed. You're just looking at your absolute doom and your helplessness as well. You're completely helpless.
Yeah. It must be a feeling of shame and horror that you've gone along with this all your life and now it's betraying you. So the Greek massacres go on and they're pretty big. I mean, we don't want to whitewash this part of it at all. They massacred all the Muslim civilians they could find, probably. Because remember, populations are much smaller at this time, 1820. I mean, the population of Greece overall was less than 1 million people. They massacre 20,000 men, women, and children in a few weeks. And they do it Rwanda style. They do it with mostly farm weapons, you know, farm tools, axes, knives, scythes, and they do it locally. The Muslims, who were once 12% of the Peloponnese population, are just gone. And the Greeks afterwards had this interesting expression when they were asked about the Muslims of the Peloponnese: the moon devoured them. I don't know what that's meant to mean, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
So these mobs were often led by clergymen. Because remember, this is a religious war. This is our religious community versus your religious community. And there were a few Albanians in the Greek community. There were a few converted Greeks in the Turkish community. But once you had made your creed of confession, you know, that was it. You were either one of us or you were the enemy. They end up, the survivors of the Greek Muslims, in a few garrison towns where they hope to find safety. But, you know, there's no real safety in these situations. What there is counter-terror. And the Turks, who have some military men among them, try to terrorize the population back into obedience with executions and a few demonstrations of military force, flags, rifles. Doesn't really matter. I mean, if they can't get to you in the day, they're going to come to your house at night and they're going to kill you. So the Peloponnese is basically cleansed, I suppose, ethnically cleansed.
Of the Muslims.
Yeah, of Muslims.
Turks and Muslims, I see.
Yeah.
It's liberated would be the other term, but
yeah, liberated.
You know, the Greek term for it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And at this point, the islands of Hydra, Spetse, Psara joined the revolutionaries. These are mostly Albanian Christians. And the Albanian Christians, as I've said many times, have their own bitter history of the Turkish conquest. I've recommended that novel, The Siege, many times. It's about the Ottoman siege of an Albanian castle involving temporary victory over the Ottomans, but the sense is they're going to get us next time. So the Albanian Christians, if you're a Christian, you're a Christian. That's it. So they join the revolutionaries. They are later going to pay for this, as so many other Greek communities did. The island of Psara is wiped off the map. Something like 10,000 inhabitants, which is a lot in this period when, you know, the whole population is maybe 900,000. They were killed and their survivors were sold into slavery. It took 100 years for the island of Psara to be a functioning community again. Wow. The surviving Albanian Christians of places like Hydra and Spetse arm their ships, though, because they're on smaller islands. It's a little safer for them. You can at least survive longer.
And it's very hilly, and
like, yeah,
it's a good place to be a guerrilla fighter. I mean, eventually, if the Ottomans will get you, they'll get you, but you can hold out for a while. Yeah.
Right. And there's the tradition, as we talked about in the last episode, about the cleft. The clefts are basically robber bands who sometimes pose as defenders of the chieftains in a familiar Jesse James, Robin Hood kind of way, and sometimes just descend on the local farms for whatever they can get. It's like, oh, we're here to liberate you. No, well, give us a chicken anyway, something like that. And the islanders arm their ships, but they do it a little smarter. They fly the Turkish flags, and they seize every Turkish ship they can. Mm. A lot of these are Turkish ships coming back from Mecca, and they express their unhappiness with being under Muslim domination by throwing the pilgrims to their deaths in the sea. They capture a few treasure ships bound for Alexandria. And the Turkish Empire at this point is barely creaking along. Once it gets you in its claws, it will rend you pretty good. But it has a lot of trouble lubricating those claws to reach out to get you. So there's local anarchy that they can't do anything about. They have a complete sway over Constantinople and most of Anatolia. But the further you go west away from that, the less power they have. And eventually they will get to these people. They will get them and kill them. But in the meantime, the Christians, which has a certain ironic tinge to it in this case, the Christians are able to, for example, take a Turkish corvette, a military vessel, bring it back to Hydra, the island, in triumph, and individually roast the 57-man crew over fires on the beach. I haven't heard anything that they ate the people.
Was it Jason and the Argonauts, the puppetoon one that has, or the stop action, that has the Cyclops roasting the members of the crew over a slow fire? I think it was Jason.
Oh, did he? I thought he just ate them raw, but maybe he does.
I seem to remember, yeah, because I can kind of remember, you know, the stop action turning of the roasting. And I think they get at least one of the guys free, as I recall.
Okay.
But it, you know, it, I could... it does seem like it could have taken place on Hydra.
Yeah, definitely.
And so that might have happened a lot. But it also, you know, brings to mind something about what happens in revolutionary situations. I mean, there's often, because of the kind of people that are sort of unleashed in these situations, there's often a very blurry line or no line between banditry and, you know, and kind of too much violence. Well, right. Really just hardcore violence, banditry, theft, and actual revolution. And they'll use the other side, the occupying side, or the power they're fighting against, will use that to, you know, to frame the whole thing as banditry. You see this over and over and over, because that does often exist. And it's one of the things I think that makes some, especially the more like very ideological, you know, the various Marxist insurgencies that didn't do that. I mean, I think of Mao's, whatever, who, very careful not to allow that sort of banditry and to distinguish themselves from other warlords and other revolutionaries. And it, you know, and it worked well. But yeah, and this is well before that period. And this is normal stuff. Yeah. It's pretty normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these people are raised on traditions of feud and endless family quarrels.
So they have a lot of pent up, you know, vengeance to spend. Yeah.
I mean, they've been saying, yes, your honor, your holiness, whatever, for a long time. And it kind of grates on the tongue, and, you know, they don't want it. But there's no use denying there were horrific things done in the Greek Revolution. There are going to be even more horrific things done in Revenge, but I don't know how that finally computes. But there's also a more interesting gender angle to this revolution. I mean, revolutions are exciting for everybody who's young, who feels underutilized by the society in which they're living, feels they could be more. Sometimes they're right about that, sometimes they're not. And especially to young women who are not entirely happy with their assigned roles. And this is a very, very patriarchal society, both Turkish and Greek. There's really no space between them in terms of patriarchal values. But there are a few wealthy women who have the money and the personal freedom in these moments of anarchy, as you said, to reinvent themselves. And one of them is famous in the Greek Revolution. She's Laskarina Bubalina, who becomes something of a pirate admiral or a privateer admiral. She gets the title of Laskarina posthumously, but she becomes captain of a vessel that she outfits. And she is actually known as Kapitanissa, which I think would be that suffix, Issa, Kapitan, Issa, as a feminizing suffix, Captainess. She is from Spezza, and she grew up learning to sail with a rich family. Her second husband is a ship owner and captain. She joins the Filiki Eteria, the Society of Friends, the Greek Revolutionary Society, and she orders the construction of her own warship. The funny thing for me, Mark, I don't know, is she names it Agamemnon. Like, why Agamemnon? He's the guy you love to hate in the Iliad. But
yeah.
She picks him anyway.
I mean, maybe a Greek could explain that. You know, maybe it means something a little different to Greek than
you know, or maybe the name in itself is admirable. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's still the big cheese. So I guess.
It's got 18 cannons, and it's a serious vessel. She helps to impose a naval blockade on the Turkish base of Nafplion, And that's a very important moment in the dead serious military side of the Greek Revolution. But she dies a few years later, embittered because she spent all her money on the revolution. This happens always in revolutions. Like people spend all their money and the revolution doesn't even say thank you, or that's what they think. And it's just, if you give money to a revolution, just assume it's gone. You know, it's like you're not going to get thanked. Too much is going on. Too many people are dying. So may as well just let it go. But she then goes back into her family and dies in a family argument. Now, what happened was her son eloped with a girl who had been promised to someone else. It's kind of interesting to think, did she give him those ideas? Or was it like...
I know.
Yeah,
I feel like I've read something about that before.
Yeah, or was it just the old Romeo and Juliet thing where the hormones were calling to them? And I don't know. But yeah, I can just see it. Well, my mom says that people should be free. Which eventually gets his mom killed. She just gets shot in a family argument. There are a lot of those primitive rifles in use here. You know, they're Greek rifles, almost like a straight stick. The stock is almost straight with the barrel. And they generally use them from the hip. They just fire from the hip because they're not very accurate at long range.
Probably don't want the anything close to your face either.
So pieces of rock would... Yeah, no, no. Then come the Ottoman reprisals. It's not pretty. The Ottoman reprisals take place everywhere within the empire. There are special reprisals in Constantinople, but everywhere else in the empire where there is a Turkish community...
You mean where there's a Greek community?
Yeah, we're dealing with different things. I'm thinking where there's a match rather than where there's kindling. But same thing. So the men are usually killed, the women and children taken into slavery. Only a tiny minority of people in either of these explosions, the Greek explosion against the Turks or the Turk explosion of vengeance against the Greeks, only a few were killed in battle. Typical of these you couldn't even call them wars, ethnic mutual killings, massacre is the norm. Battle is highly unusual and usually avoided. Because why would you waste men when you could just descend on the village when the men are all gone and kill everybody, take everybody into slavery that you want? Above all, this is meant on the idea of community. The Turks, as an empire, had long considered all the peoples of their empire as a community, and they had community responsibility for the actions of every member of that community. In a sense, the Greeks at this time had a patriarchal version of the same thing. Like, if your daughter is dishonored by someone's son and that son has escaped, you know, like the admiral's son did, you kill her.
Right.
You kill anyone who's responsible and who's on the wrong side of the family. So the Turkish Empire considers every single member of the Greek community to be guilty, even though the Greek community was particularly far spread on the islands, like all over the place.
And they would be in Anatolia, right? So they would be spread around in different parts of the Ottoman Empire.
And the news was so slow in getting around that they may not even have heard of what was going on, but they were still responsible. So, for example, in the April 10th, 1821, in Constantinople, the patriarch of the Orthodox, Greek Orthodox community, Gregory V, is allowed to say Mass and lynched on his way out of Mass, hanged, which is a death for thieves traditionally, and then thrown into the sea, into the Bosporus. Other Greek merchants and priests are destroyed. And then maybe the worst feature of this, what do the Jews have to do with it? Nothing. The Jews, but the Jews get scapegoated for his death because, I don't know, some dim tradition that, you know, the Jews betrayed Christ or something. So Jewish people in Greek communities get scapegoated. There's a pogrom in Odessa where Greek immigrants spread rumors that it was the Jews who killed the patriarch. It's kind of bizarre. Like, you don't think there's another suspect? You know, you don't think there's somebody who's got a record and an MO here?
Well, I mean, I think that's the point, that they took, they pogromed who they could.
Right.
And the Jews were, you know, the Ottomans weren't going to come to their defense, nor were the Russians. No. And the Jews weren't massacred in Constantinople. So therefore they must have
which would be inherently suspicious.
Exactly.
So there's a flood of massacres. In Constantinople, first of all, on a single day, because these are very sadistic things, they're drawn out. You know, people can't leave, really. So one day, it's shopkeeper day. So they round up 450 Greek shopkeepers and sent them to work in the mines, which is a death sentence. A few days later, five archbishops and three bishops are executed. The next month, at least 70 Greeks are executed in Constantinople. But it's not just execution. Remember, the Sultan has ordered Muslim subjects to arm themselves and to take matters into their own hands. And there's testimony from a British resident of Constantinople who said, "In Constantinople, it became dangerous for foreigners to venture into the streets, lest they be accosted, robbed, beaten, and spat on." And this is even European foreigners who had a certain immunity. "As armed Janissaries roamed the streets, Greeks were killed in cold blood. Out for a walk, the chaplain at the British Embassy saw someone strolling ahead up a narrow alley, casually stab a man to death with a single strike. Watching the victim fall, the killer then wiped his knife and went into a cafe for a quiet smoke." So the killings are that casual because no one is going to accuse you of anything for killing a designated victim, someone who's a designated Greek and therefore liable to death. There are all kinds of refinements of cruelty here. When the Ottoman fleet returned to Constantinople after its first cruise against the rebels, a victory celebration was arranged for the delectation and terrorization of the populace, which is a thing, delectation and terrorization, definitely a thing.
And the terrorization is part of the delectation as well.
Yes, absolutely. "As each ship entered harbor, the prisoners, who were often Greek seamen working on the Turkish fleet, were herded to deck with the ropes around their necks and dropped from various parts of the rigging until all the bowsprits and yardarms were crowded with men struggling in the agonies of death." Yeah. And I can imagine, I have a bad imagination. I can imagine the way this went. Like, you know, you do a few for the obvious method first, and then you do somebody from the highest mast and then from a really small mast so they struggle longer. And God knows. I mean, there's a lot of scope for imagination there, and I'm sure they used all of it. Mm-hmm. 40,000 Greeks try to flee Constantinople, but it's difficult. You can't flee into Anatolia. you get off by ship, if you get off at all. There's the Danube provinces where Ypsilantes tried to start his idiotic revolt. But what might be Thessaly in the traditional Greek nomenclature. But those are crowded with Ottoman garrisons. And they massacre many of these fleeing Greeks on their way. And then you've got the Russian border. And Russia has not always been that friendly to wartime immigrants. So
Russia wants to choose when it wants to fight the Turks and choose its wars for its interests. And yeah, it doesn't want to get, this is pretty standard, but it doesn't want to get sucked in on somebody else's schedule.
And there's still kind of a reaction. And this is changing as the stories of nightmare reprisals percolate through the European world. But initially, there's a feeling in the Russian upper class, which is very royalist and kind of dumb when it isn't revolutionary, that we must not encourage rebellion at all. All the European upper classes have gone into, I don't know, something you see in Victorian British literature, which is intentional stupidity. Like the French at the beginning of the 19th century were way too radical, and they kept thinking all these things and thinking, what if it's not that way? What if it's another way? And so we are going to stop that. We are just going to say, it is the way it is. And if you violate that, if you dare to question that, you're a dangerous person. So there's not much tolerance for rebels or revolutionary ideas in general. Meanwhile, the Greeks in the later 18-teens and the early 1820s are left with the leadership of the Klephs. And that's not something you want to rely on very much. They can sometimes be, I mean, they're bandits, basically. So sometimes they can be good guerrilla strategists, but they're not going to be very concerned about civilian life, and they're always going to be ready to make a deal with your enemies. One of these people becomes identified with the rebellion, the Greek rebellion, Kolokotronis, a general, a cleft, and the word comes from steel, like kleptomania, a warrior bandit, Armatolos, that is Christian irregular serving the Ottoman military, and also as kapos. I imagine that was the term evolved into kapo, I don't know. Militiamen employed by the Greek notables of the Peloponnese. But he serves the revolution for a while because he's down in the Peloponnese, and he sees the possibilities of the revolution. If you're a military band that's just basically living by savagery, or as they say, your wits, you probably welcome any sign that the order is collapsing because you think you'll be, you know, warrior of the wasteland. And his way of fighting had its greatest moment at the Battle of Dervanakia, where he took no part initially in the battle, but he let a Turkish force pass through two mountain passes that his sentries controlled down to besiege a Greek fortress, which they failed to take because the Ottoman Empire is really barely creaking along in its distant provinces. And then they had to march back, because they had no food. And he deployed his men with their little clunky rifles in the mountain passes. And suddenly, you know, their weapons became very effective. That was how they wanted to fight. Like, you want to go up this narrow trail into the mountains? We'll shoot you. I mean, we can't miss at that range. Mm. And so he forced a Turkish force into near starvation. Then they finally made a rush and they got over the mountains, but there were about a third of as many of them as there were in the beginning. So you can make war effectively if you do it the cleft way, but you can't really make war with these robbers in the way that the naive European imports mm-hmm. thought you could, like standing in line and in uniform and firing at the enemy. The cleft tradition is not kindly. he tends to he has scribes who take his dictation, and he says to a bishop who he would otherwise deal with very respectfully, but now it's a matter of money. So in one letter to the bishop, he says, "Send me the money without fail. If you don't, I'll be at war with you without mercy, without end, to be carried on by my descendants." So war is a hereditary thing, yeah. A hereditary feud.
That's when you reach for the Venmo and you immediately send
the money. Oh, okey-doke, yeah. Yeah. No, PayPal? My account, yeah. He fucked up, you know. Yeah, yeah. I got it. And he says to a village which is resisting paying him, "So long as there's a Kolokotronis family in the world." And you can see the Rodney Dangerfield jokes here. It's like that it to English speaking ears, it doesn't quite have the same dignity. You know, yeah. "So long as there's a Kolokotronis family in the world, revenge shall be sought in rivers of men's blood. This is my patriotic duty." So patriotism to him means something very different. It means loyalty to your family above right. all, because the family is all you have when society at large is controlled by forces hostile to you. So they see the prospect of forging a national identity and a national army as something that's going to ruin their livelihood.
Yeah.
So they're not thrilled with that, but they will cooperate, and they do cooperate with the Philhellenic revolutionary forces now and then. They are also very good at massacres, and they, for example, massacre in Tripolitsa after taking the capital of the Peloponnese. Mm. They have a vengeance massacre of Muslims and Jews in revenge for an Ottoman massacre of Greeks in the same town recently. 6,000 to 30,000 are killed. I mean, the numbers are so vague because these are actually very isolated, primitive communities at this time. And nobody quite knows how many people have been killed. Then, tilting the balance, Ali Pasha, who, as we mentioned, is the sort of semi-independent puppet of northwestern Greece. He's sometimes a Turkish vassal, sometimes not, depending on where his advantage is. There's a lot of cynicism going on.
I mean, you can kind of think of, I'm sorry, like in that relationship of Kadyrov, you know, the Chechen leader. Like
right.
he serves a function and Putin doesn't control him. And he crosses boundaries a lot that no one else would be able to cross but he also keeps the place quiet enough. And that's the hardest and main thing that Putin wants out of him, keeping it quiet. If you couldn't keep it quiet, that's the one thing that would get him taken out. The fact that he's assassinated some big name Russians beloved in the West and caused Putin a lot of problems, and not just that, but you know, a lot of other yeah. stuff. That is all very bad, but a price to pay. And so I imagine, I don't know, that's one version of how you can imagine this.
I think it's a really yeah. good version. Yeah, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's probably the closest analogy. he dies after playing a sort of triple game, which is standard in his part of the world, standard in the cleft world. He works for the Ottomans. He works for himself. He's always cherished this idea of, well, like the Kadyrov clan, of becoming king of his own realm, which is this realm on the border of Greece and Albania. And sometimes the Turks are weak enough to let him do that. But finally, he gets accosted by officials from the Sultan who have a firman, an edict for his execution. They've blasted into his castle and he's going to die. Ali told the official to stay back until he had read the document, but the Pasha ignored him and called for him to comply. Ali pulled out his pistol and fired at him. The Pasha returned fire while his chief of staff managed to wound Ali in the arm with his sword. Now, first of all, you get a sense of why these people rely on swords and knives after they have firearms. They don't have the best firearms.
Yes.
These are not like Colt revolvers, okay? Like if you make a little firecracker noise and nothing happens to the guy you're shooting at in the same room.
Yes.
And then he makes the same noise and finally someone with a sword cuts you. and that's the first
you're gonna have to shoot him from fairly close anyway, so you may as well stab him to be more sure. But
the stab goes in, the shooting doesn't always work. The resulting gunfight only ended when Ali was mortally wounded in the abdomen by a bullet, which is like the worst way to die. So he finally dies.
Lee Harvey Oswald, the Jack Ruby, and Ruby himself stuck it in like a sword, stuck it right into Lee Harvey's abdomen and shot him. Right.
Yeah. So finally, the Turkish authorities in general are sort of getting their machinery clanking into order, and they manage to take revenge on the island of Chios. And this is the worst. This is the details are really awful. 100,000 Chiots killed or enslaved. Many of them were beheaded or tortured to death. Ears cut off the corpses or sometimes the living people to show to Ottoman accountants for payments, because you get paid by the ear or sometimes by the head. The survivors are about 20,000, but the island is never the same. They never quite recover that.
That's insane.
Considering
the population at that time.
Yeah, they didn't have that many people to be fooling around with. So there's a kind of traditional revenge in which a Greek captain, a pirate captain, takes advantage of a feast taking place on an Ottoman ship and pushes a fire ship into the ship, and then it blows up, killing 2,000 men. I don't know if that's real or if it's just one of the traditions that, you know, oppressed peoples tell themselves, like just to make it better.
If Archimedes was around, I'd believe it. But otherwise, yeah, you're right.
Because, you know, you can put a lot of fire onto a ship. You can burn a ship. But they normally have the sense to keep the gunpowder in a safe place. And until you hit the core of the ship and it really starts burning, you're not going to get the powder magazines. Okay, now we come back to the Philhellenes. And like everybody else in this story, they're kind of late getting into the action. There have been waves of Philhellenes landing in Greece, but most of them did not do well, and they didn't find any sort of structure that could use them. As one scholar said, the Philhellenes were almost all young men under 25, many of them students, but there were plenty of exceptions. In a dark cafe in the back streets of a Greek city in the spring of 1822, a German volunteer encountered a young boy fully armed drinking wine with the others. He was astonished when he realized the boy was really a fiery Spanish woman, Madame Torricelli, who had accompanied her husband to Greece. She was unusual, though not unique, as a female fighter. And when you combine her story with Bubalina's story, you begin to wonder if there wasn't a trend for women, young people, others who were not at home in regular European society to jump on the revolutionary bandwagon. Like, okay, things are changing and they're changing in Greece. Let's do it. So the Philhellenes slowly gain traction, even though many of them are embittered and go home or beg for money to go back to Munich or wherever, anywhere but here, because they realize these are not the heirs of Plato. These are very, very poor people who are deeply Christian and don't want to talk about anything else. It's sort of like when bands meet real Americana people, like that movie you recommended where that guy who did that song, I was doing all right and spent my last dime on a wishing well.
Daniel Johnston.
Yeah, Daniel Johnston.
Yes.
And Sonic Youth meets him in New York, but yes. He's on a Christian kick and all he'll talk about is Christ.
He's too authentic. Yes.
Yeah, way too authentic. Yeah. And these Greeks are too authentic for most of the Philhellenes. They never heard of Plato and they don't want to. The Germans, who are the bulk of these people, and the English train a few Greek soldiers, mostly sons of the middle class, and risk a battle finally. In 1822, the Battle of Peta, the Greek forces are encamped at Peta. 7,000 Ottoman troops attack their positions, advancing before dawn in a crescent formation. Because you have to remember, the Ottomans were not used to pitched battles at this point anyway. They were used to the occasional massacre. So they're not very good troops. The Ottomans advance before dawn in a crescent formation with 600 horsemen charging toward the ridge. The Ottoman cavalry were surprised that no one fired on them. And only when they reached 100 feet away from the ridge, the Philhellenes and Greek regulars returned fire, bringing down a lethal rain on the Ottomans. The reason you have to do this is before mid-19th century, before the Civil War, for example, muskets just fired out a big BB and fired in the general direction you pointed, but not with any accuracy at all.
Right.
So if you fire too early against cavalry charges, it's wasted. Mm. But if you wait until the very last minute, you know, when you see the whites of their eyes, then there's so much mass of humanity and horse in front of you that you are bound to hit something. And that's what works. So this works. The Ottomans keep charging, charge again, and take heavy losses every time. And then in other parts of the battle, the Albanian regulars on the Turkish side attack, but are repulsed by the Greek Cleft's men. And Bacolus, the Cleft, who's serving with the Greeks nominally, quits the battle. He's been paid. I mean, this is the fix is in. This is what happens in traditional warfare involving Clefts. Bacolus deliberately left his right flank unguarded and made no effort to fire upon the Albanians as they advanced. When the Albanians scaled the ridge, Bacolus orders his men to retreat. The Albanians made no effort to attack him, as they had agreed with Bacolus before the battle that he would betray his own side. With the Albanians on the upper ridge, the other Greek forces were driven off. Once the ridge was in Ottoman hands, the Ottomans seized the village and attacked the Greek forces. Attacked from all sides, the forces on the lower ridge are overwhelmed. Most of the Philhellenes and Greek regulars, who were now disorganized and out of formation, made a desperate last stand against Ottoman cavalry, who cut them down without exception. Bacchollis' treachery resulted in the overall defeat of the Greeks. I mean, Bacchollis is simply making a business decision here. Mm-hmm. I mean, and he sees that as his job. He doesn't really see the Greeks, the Hellenes. What is that? You know, mm-hmm. that I've got my people to take care of, and I have to make a calculation here. Are these Philhellene people, whoever they are, a bunch of weird foreigners, really going to win against the Turks, who have won every single time for centuries? I don't think so. And the Turks are going to pay me. I'll keep my little fiefdom in the hills, and I can't lose. So right. He makes a sensible decision. But luckily for the Greeks, the Ottomans are almost equally slow and incompetent. As one scholar says, an astonishing example of the incompetence of the Ottoman campaign in Greece, incapable of securing its basic logistical needs, poorly led, the army had been unable to make its overwhelming numbers translate into victory. So while this is happening, and as the Ottomans are just barely getting their proverbial act together, Philhellenic communities are forming in London, Berlin, Paris. The war, surprisingly, is going better for the Greeks than it should have, just because the Turks are so hopelessly disorganized in Greece. The insurgents now hold the southern Greek mainland, many islands, and they have a fleet of pirates that's actually competing against the Turkish navy. And this is the situation when Byron lands in Greece. Mm. In 1823, after he's persuaded by Edward Blanquier of the London Philhellenics to go to Greece. And Byron first says, well, what can I do? Byron says, Blanquier seemed to think that I might be of some use, though what, he did not exactly specify. Goethe recommended that he do so. A recommendation from Goethe is a big deal the 1820s. And Byron was so excited, he promised to go see Goethe in Germany if I ever come back. Byron brings his very strange friend, Edward Trelawney, and they head to Greece in a ship named Hercules.
A better name than Agamemnon.
Definitely. Bishop Ignatius, who's Ignatius, who's basically the Greek liaison with the European Philhellenes, has a very cold-blooded, sensible attitude towards him. The nobleman, Lord Byron, is on his way to see the state of affairs in Greece. He has money. He is in favor of the Greeks, has important friends, and can bring benefit provided he is pleased. The bishop tells Mavro Cordatos, do whatever you can to please Byron.
I think here could be a good place to wrap it up, because this is setting up Byron in the war, right?
Okay, good.
Okay, that was great. Thanks, John.
Thanks.
That was part three of Byron and the Greek Revolt or Greek Revolution. And thanks, everybody, Brendan, and talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.